Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. The book is The Alzheimer's Antidote. Our guest, the author, Amy Berger. And the book is highly recommended by such luminaries as Dr. David Perlmutter. He is very happy with this summary of a comprehensive approach to preventing dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So, Amy, you know, we talk a lot about theories, the potential causation, but is there any evidence that clinical studies been done, even on a limited basis, to show that a comprehensive lifestyle approach with diet, supplements, stress reduction, certain supplements can work for slowing progression towards Alzheimer's?
This stuff is definitely in its infancy. There are some very small scale studies. There's a couple of different studies that have been done. The one that I'm most heartened by and most encouraged by is by Dale Bredesen, who I think he's out in California. He has a multifaceted
guest on this program. Yeah, we did a
podcast. Oh, great. Yeah. So he's got this multifaceted intervention protocol that is not a ketogenic diet, but it's a low glycemic diet, a good high, slightly higher fat diet. He introduces exercise, like you said, stress reduction, small amounts of fasting. You know, he wants people to go at least 12 hours between dinner one evening and breakfast the next morning, getting micronutrient replete. So he does a slew of tests with regard to, you know, vitamin and mineral status, hormone status. He looks more at thyroid and estrogen, testosterone, all of that stuff, to get that stuff optimized. And his results were really, really promising. And it was a very small study, but they're replicating it, and they're trying to get more practitioners all over the country trained in his protocol. And these were people who, some of them were diagnosed with Alzheimer's, some of them were sort of self-diagnosed, subjective cognitive impairment, but almost all of them, except for one person that had very, very advanced severe dementia, all of them had significant improvement. Some of these people were so far gone that they had to quit working. You know, they were not able to hold down their job anymore, and now they're either back in the workforce or they would be able to go back if they wanted to. I mean, noticeable improvements in their ability to just handle their everyday tasks. And besides that, I mean, talking about the ketogenic diet specifically, unfortunately, most of the studies that have been done with these exogenous ketone formulas. So there really hasn't been a whole lot looking at the diet. I think the diet is the next step. I think that's the next frontier, but at least we have data showing that when ketone levels are elevated in the body, these people, I would say most of them, do show improvement. There are some people who do not improve, and I think there's a reason for that, but with the exogenous ketones alone, with no other intervention, many of these people show significant improvement.
Things like MCT oil and coconut oil have been touted. Those are the studies you're talking about.
Yeah, they do MCT oil, coconut oil, but also actual beta-hydroxybutyrate formulas. You know, they're starting to become available to the public now through
medical
various
foods.
Companies.
Yeah,
right,
foods.
Right.
And so those can be prescribed by doctors. They tend to be pricey. Sometimes insurance covers them. But it's easier than going on a full-blown ketogenic diet.
Right. It is easier, but it is my hunch that these exogenous ketones or the MCT oils, while they are very, very good for managing the symptoms and giving you acute improvement in the short term, they're really not doing anything to address the pathology, to address the actual problem. And I feel like that's where the diet has the advantage. So I think where the real power is in a combination. Do the diet and take the ketones. Now, of course, for someone with very severe dementia or someone who's very old, you're not going to get somebody to give up their cereal and orange juice for eggs cooked in coconut oil, you know, overnight. So for someone who really is unable or unwilling to change their diet, definitely get these ketones into them any way you can. But to whatever extent you can change somebody's diet, even if you can't go full-blown ketogenic, if you can just take out or reduce the most obvious offenders, the most obvious sources of refined sugar and starch, you know, start there. And anything you can do to make inroads is better than nothing. Like, if that's the message that people can get, is just try. We're not powerless against this.
And what's the principle? What's the physiological principle that suggests that fat metabolism is superior to sugar metabolism in the aging brain?
Good question. Excellent question. If the primary problem in Alzheimer's is that these neurons are atrophying and dying because they're not being fueled properly, it's only their glucose metabolism that's damaged, not their ketone metabolism. And we generate ketones generally when we're on a high-fat, very low-carbohydrate diet, or when we get them through some other way, like MCT or coconut oil.
Or when we're fasting and, or starving, because then we're burning
right.
down our own fat.
Right, fasting or starving or a fasting mimicking diet, which is, you know, what a very low carb diet would be. And they've actually shown in animals and in humans that even when the glucose metabolism of the brain is impaired, the ketone metabolism is not. Now, to what extent somebody would be able to reverse damage that has already taken hold, we're not sure. You know, maybe all we can hope for is to slow the progression. And during the course of slowing the progression, these people maybe have an improved quality of life and their caregivers have an improved quality of life if these people are thinking more clearly with these ketones, even if they're still ultimately going to progress and lose their lives to this illness. I think some of the damage is reversible because they've even one of Dr. Bredesen's studies showed they actually the volume of one of his subjects' brains increased. I mean, you can see this. You can see this on the brain scans where some of the physical matter of the brain shrinks, and then he had it done again, and it had increased. I mean, they'd never seen anything like it before. So I think there's a lot of promise here, but it is in its infancy, and I don't want people to come away thinking that this is a sure thing, or, you know, we need people to start trying this. We can't – are we going to wait another 30 or 40 years for Eli Lilly to come out with some blockbuster drug? Well, you know, we have to take control ourselves at this point.
Indeed. And so you weigh in against the use of certain medications that may impair nutrient absorption. Or even the popular cholesterol-lowering medications.
Right. There may be a proper situation for some of these drugs. I am not completely against them, but so many of our elderly population they're on these drugs. And they're on these drugs largely because at the time they were initially given them 20, 30 years ago, it was just the standard of care that if your total cholesterol was over 200, you're going on a statin, end of story. You know, there was no discussion about, well, what's my HDL? What's my particle count? Even if any of that matters, you know, there's so much controversy about cholesterol and about even the particle count and the particle number and all that. And what we do know is that the brain is a very, very cholesterol-rich organ. It is literally built out of cholesterol. And and study after study has also shown that higher cholesterol in later life is protective, not just of cognitive function, but of all-cause mortality. The higher the cholesterol in many people, the lower their risk for early death. And again, I'm not saying that nobody should be on a statin, that there's no place for these drugs. I mean, it's on a case-by-case basis, but I really do think that not only are these drugs not helping cognitive function, I think they're actually significantly contributing. And if you go on the Mayo Clinic website or if you go on the FDA's website, they very clearly list memory problems as a side effect of these drugs. And if you know how important cholesterol is to the brain, that is not a surprise at all.
Indeed. And there are many other drugs that are administered, especially to the elder population, that impair brain function. For example, you know, some of the typical antihistamines. Some of the drugs that are used as non-prescription sleep meds, you know, like Tylenol PM. The PM is usually some kind of antihistamine that has been demonstrated to have adverse effect on brain function. A lot of the urinary drugs have what are called cholinergic, anticholinergic side effects, which are getting in the way of the main chemical messenger in the brain, acetylcholine. Which is what helps you form memories.
Right. And it's unfortunate because so many of these drugs, they might be helpful. You know, it's not that they're ineffective, but none of these drugs are designed to be taken for decades at a time. You know, I feel like so many people walk away from a doctor's office with a prescription, but nobody's monitoring over the long term to see whether it's prudent for that person to remain on a drug for 20 years or 30 years. Because this stuff doesn't happen, like we said earlier, this doesn't happen overnight. If you take a statin drug, you're not going to develop Alzheimer's within a week. But maybe if your brain has been deprived of proper cholesterol for 10 years, 15 years, maybe 5 years, and even drugs as benign or quote-unquote benign as antacids, you know, as a prescription, as a proton pump inhibitor or something, we're deliberately impairing the body's ability to absorb nutrients, nutrients that the brain needs to function properly. Like, to me, this is not a mystery at all, but I'm not trying to oversimplify. I mean, there's more to it than this, but we're just making things worse in ways that are completely avoidable.
Indeed. This is a point where we usually pause to allow one of our sponsors to share a message with us. So, Amy, stay with us, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Alzheimer's antidote.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code HOFFMAN at checkout. At tryzona.com.
Thanks, audience, for listening, and thank you for supporting our good sponsors here on Intelligent Medicine. So, returning to the subject of the Alzheimer's antidote, when it comes to environmental toxicity, you know, a lot has been made of mercury and lead, cadmium. Could these be factors in contributing to the epidemic of dementia?
They could be. To be honest with you, I haven't looked at that side of the research that much. There are, you know, whether it's aluminum or lead or mercury, some Alzheimer's patients do seem to have an elevated toxic burden. I'm just not as familiar with that research. To the extent that that is affecting oxidative stress in the brain, maybe, or, you know, detoxification processes, or even the glucose metabolism, then I could definitely see a role in that.
With the potential damage to the mitochondria, which are, after all, very sensitive to toxins, even chemical toxins like PCBs and so on.
Right.
Yep. So homocysteine is a factor that you mentioned. And, you know, when we're doing our blood panel to see if a patient is susceptible to Alzheimer's disease, to, you know, checking risk factors, how does homocysteine fit in the picture?
Well, I mean, elevated homocysteine seems to be a risk factor for cardiovascular issues. And if I remember off the top of my head, homocysteine can be elevated due to B6 deficiency, B12 deficiency, folate deficiencies. And I think the B12 is just so critical for cognitive function. But for me, that high homocysteine might be a marker for poor nutrient status more than anything else.
And correctable when we administer the right B vitamins.
Right.
You're not, when it comes to cholesterol, coming back to that subject, you're not averse to people consuming cholesterol. You know, we have sort of cholesterol phobia these days. People are eating egg beaters. They're carefully trimming the fat from their meat. They're still into recommendations that we switch from butter to vegetable oil, many of which is, you know, refined and poor quality. You're not averse to animal proteins that are rich in even saturated fats.
No, I am not averse to those at all. You know, we did say the E4s might want to go easy on saturated. The jury's kind of still out on that. But generally speaking, you know, nature did not put yolks in eggs to kill us. Nature did not put fat in ruminant animals to kill us. People don't have to go out of their way to gorge on it. But I think finally the tide is starting to turn, albeit slowly. But you know, even the conventional medical world, I think, is starting to recognize that cholesterol in food doesn't automatically become cholesterol lodged in our arterial walls. And the saturated fat doesn't, you know, it also is not, hopefully we will see the death of the phrase artery clogging saturated fat. That's, I mean, awesome. That has,
sure, yeah.
Right. And I hopefully we'll stop seeing it, but, again, there's just populations that have been eating this stuff forever that don't show the kinds of diseases that we have today.
When it comes to supplements, you have a section on that in the book. There are many supplements that are touted as having a benefit for memory. What are some of your favorites?
My favorites, definitely B12. I know we're beating that drum hard, but B12 deficiency, one of the signs is memory impairment. And I think that, at least in the early stages, B12 deficiency is actually sometimes mistaken for dementia. So B12,
even with a relatively definitely normal B12, you know, I've seen patients who, you know, they say, well, the B12 is a little low, but it's within the normal limits. They set the limits so low that patients who have intermediate B12 don't get any attention. But studies show
they're
somewhat cognitively impaired. You know, not
right.
You know, they're not classically deficient, but they deserve more B12 supplementation.
Right. I agree completely. And the ranges sometimes are so wide that you could be quote unquote normal and be literally 3 or 4 times lower than somebody else, and you'd both be considered normal. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an issue. So I do love B12. I think zinc, like I said, many Alzheimer's patients are low on zinc, which I think is why a loss or an impairment of the sense of smell is kind of an early warning sign of dementia, because it's also a result of zinc deficiency, is loss of sense of taste and smell. I think omega-3s are extremely important for this population for brain health.
Which is more important, DHA or EPA, in your opinion?
For the brain, probably DHA.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
I think DHA. Yeah, and they do. I mean, I would just like to eat fatty fish, but if somebody doesn't want to eat fish, they do make sort of high DHA fish oil. You just have to look for it. So I like choline a lot. And of course, egg yolks are really like one of the top sources of choline. Anything, and assuming somebody has an insulin issue, anything that can help there. So alpha lipoic acid might be helpful.
Chromium
picolinate or some other form of chromium. Now, the thing is, they've done some limited studies on some of these supplements. And, you know, I got to be honest with your audience, this stuff does not, it's not super impressive, but the studies that have been done are done on Alzheimer's patients eating their habitual high carbohydrate, poor nutrient quality diet.
Right.
Could we have some clinical trials using zinc or chromium or, you know, L-carnitine or DHA in a population eating a low carb, nutrient dense, ketogenic diet? I feel like, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you take a severely demented, very ill person and give them zinc and nothing happens. You know, it's not enough. Like, what? It's almost laughable to think that we would think it's enough.
Indeed. And you mentioned some other supplements. PQQ is a little bit of an exotic supplement. And I always trip over that, what that is, pure, I'm not even going to go there. It's one of the new kids on the block, a potent antioxidant that's said to work in the brain. Data on that or any encouraging suggestions that might be useful?
Encouraging is probably the best word for it. It's kind of like I said before, they've done some small studies and, you know, small results, very small improvements, but I think combining that with some of these other interventions. And I think that's where, you know, Dr. Bredesen, he may have even said it when you interviewed him, when he was trying to get funding for his studies and he wanted to have all of these different approaches, this completely multifactorial intervention. And they said, well, that's really complex. You must not know how clinical trials work. And he said, well, he said, you must not understand how Alzheimer's works because you can't just do one thing. So I think, you know, PQQ, changing your diet and lifestyle is going to have the most effect. What some of these supplements might do is just be even better, just add a little extra bonus to it. But to take these supplements in the absence of a much more fundamental change, I don't think is going to do a whole lot.
When it comes to other lifestyle facets Exercise is certainly a key element. What are the studies saying about the effect of exercise on brain function?
Pretty much what we would expect. I mean, it's so cliched, this, oh, diet and exercise, but it's cliched because it's true. Exercise is very good for brain health. Now, I think there's probably multiple things going on there. One of them is it's really good for insulin sensitivity. So if you can remain active, you know, especially if you can do intense things once in a while, it's really good for glucoregulation and insulin sensitivity. The other thing is exercise increases brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which actually helps you make new neurons. You know, it literally helps you rebuild and repair your brain. Which is, you know, maybe that's...
That's like Miracle-Gro for your neurons. That's good stuff.
Exact. That's such a... Oh, my God. I'm going to steal that phrase from you. Yes. That's that's a great way to put it.
So other factors related to lifestyle... You know, stress is blamed for a lot of things, but is there any evidence that stress has a damaging effect on brain function?
They've done some studies where some of these folks do have elevated cortisol, but I think most of it is more anecdotal in terms of a lot of these people either self-reporting or their family members report that their loved one with dementia was kind of like that type A personality, always on, always working, always charging hard. And that's great. You know, and in America, we have this idealized work ethic, but we miss the part where we take a little time to recharge, where we, you know, just let ourselves relax. But there's not a whole bunch of studies on, you know, specifically the role of stress in making this worse or in bringing it on in the first place.
But certainly, you know, part of the blue zone strategy, you know, parts of the world where people live a long time, is a comprehensive strategy of diet, social connection, sometimes spirituality, freedom from unrelenting stress. These are the common factors that help people live longer and clearly could have a protective effect on brain function. So, all right, so... The book is The Alzheimer's Antidote, Using a Low-Carb, High-Fat Diet to Fight Alzheimer's Disease, Memory Loss, and Cognitive Decline. It's a comprehensive metabolic and lifestyle approach by today's guest, Amy Berger. And Amy, so what's today's Television Medicine take-home message? What are you looking for our listeners to do? And do you have any additional resources where they can get more information besides the book?
Well, my website is TuitNutrition, TUITNutrition.com. It's mostly just a blog now. I do want to make it more content heavy for people that want to get started with low carb diet, you know, basics of what to eat, what not to eat, and how to jump in. I will be updating the website alzheimersantidote.com. Right now it's just kind of a holding place for the book, but that will be updated with resources specific to Alzheimer's. And the takeaway message is just two things, and it's one, that we do not need to be hopeless. There are a lot of unanswered questions regarding Alzheimer's. There's a lot we don't know, but that doesn't mean there's nothing we do know. It doesn't mean that we have no actionable information right now. And the second thing is, not everybody needs to follow a very low carbohydrate diet, but I think in order to, the best thing that we can do to potentially prevent this is to stay insulin sensitive and just manage blood glucose. And some people will be able to do that eating a fairly high carbohydrate diet, and some of us won't. You just have to kind of keep an eye on your blood work.
Right. It has to be individualized. And some people genetically are very susceptible, or maybe their early life experiences render them more susceptible. And they got to really rein it in. Other people, you know, perhaps at a higher level of metabolism, or if they're able to undertake more exercise, maybe they can get away with more. So you have to tailor it.
Right.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us. Book again, The Alzheimer's Antidote. We'll put a link to it on our website when we post the podcast. Thanks, Amy Berger, for joining us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I had a great time.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.